So last week we talked about we finished the slides on statistics. We had an interesting discussion on the topic of science, making a believable argument, proving things that are kind of unbelievable for other people. That was all useful. It's good to realize it as a scientist. But today we will talk about causal graphs. I don't think I have talked about this at all, right? Causal graphs are going to be useful for us. I talked for two lectures already, so my voice is weaker than it used to be today, this morning. Causal graphs are going to be useful in understanding what happens in research design. So that's the topic of today. I think it will take most of the class, maybe the whole class even. So typically, when you take a statistics textbook, there will be no mention of a causality except for a standard sentence. That sounds a little cliche. Correlation does not mean causation. In research design textbooks, where you talk about designing experiments, conducting empirical work, they have to talk about causality because most of experiments, most empirical work is about establishing causality. You want to learn what causes what. They use a lot of substitute terms like confounding factors, latent variable, intervening variable. They all have causal meaning. They are just intimidated by this idea that we don't talk about causation because it's risky to talk about causation. So in the case of research design, you cannot really avoid talking about causation because the goal is to establish causation. So how are probability and causality related to each other? It often leaves the students of statistics confused. What exactly does correlation mean about causation? Not knowing it is just a handicap, so I'm going to try to fix that problem in your case. Briefly, kind of plainly speaking, they are very strongly related. And when you have a causal graph, like in this case, flu and fever as variables are going to be correlated or dependent in general, because flu may cause fever. So flu is going to be dependent probabilistically on fever, and fever on flu. They're going to be correlated. So a causal graph results in probabilistic dependencies. I'm going to use this example causal graph on the slides. I constructed it myself. I'll tell more about it later. But for now, what I will do is I will move back to Bayesian networks. Bayesian networks are capable of representing causality. So what I will do is I will, let's see, I have to go back here. And we'll play a little bit with causality. Okay, where is causality in English? Aha, I don't have it here, but I'll find it. Maybe here. Sorry, I am prepared. I don't have that. Oh yeah, here it is. Maybe make it copy. Oh, I had it here. Sorry. Causality. Here it is. So what you will see here is you will see a collection of models that are, most of them are causal. When they are not causal, I'll tell you about it. So here's the first simple model. I will explain you three rules that that are easy to remember about the interaction of causality and probability. Understanding these three rules is important in later analyzing causal graphs for experiments. So, flu can cause fever. Fever can cause shivering. Shivering can be observed. So we have a chain of variables that are connected through a causal chain of links. Everything on this chain is going to be dependent on one another. Suppose we observe, I observe that he here, he's not here, but that he is shivering. I think, okay, so I'm observing it. You see, the probability of shivering goes up because I'm observing it. I hope I'm not wrong. He's shivering. Please note that also the probability of fever went up. Maybe he's shivering because of fever. There may be other reasons. Maybe there are some, the person has some psychological problems at the moment. Maybe it's, what is this disease called? When epilepsy, yes. Maybe it's epilepsy, but in any case, it could be also fever. So the probability of fever goes up, and the probability of flu also goes up when I observe shivering. Please note, they all are dependent on one another. The same if I learn that he has flu, then the probability of fever will go up, probability that the person may be shivering goes up, and that somebody will notice that he is shivering will also go up. So everything on this chain of things becomes dependent. I can break that dependence by observing any of the variables. Suppose I know that the person has fever. The person tells me that. He measured this this morning, his fever. Of course, when he observed fever, probability of flu goes up, shivering and observation of shivering goes up too. But the dependence between flu and shivering goes away. I know the person has fever. And now he tells me, oh, I have flu. Please note that the probability of shivering doesn't go up, doesn't change. The same if he has fever and I observe shivering. The probability that there is really shivering goes up. But it tells me nothing about the cause of fever. It can be flu, it can be meningitis, it can be pneumonia, anything really. So observing something on the chain makes things independent, breaks the chain. So the first rule, a chain of things going in one direction makes things dependent on that chain. Observing any of the events, any of the variables on the chain, breaks it. Here is another thing, the second rule, a common cause. Shoe size and reading ability are very strongly dependent. People who have small shoes cannot read too well. People who have large shoes can typically read quite well. Why is that? Well, it's because of a common cause. Age, when people are age of one, they have very small shoes, and they cannot read well. As the age increases, both the shoe size and the reading ability increases. So things can become dependent through a common cause. There's a strong correlation between ice cream consumption and drowning. So if you hear that there was a lot of ice cream consumed in Białystok, for example, you can expect that there were more people who have drowned in Białystok also. If you read in a newspaper that many people drowned today, you can safely assume that there's going to be more ice cream consumed on that day. The explanation of that correlation is also through a common cause. Outside temperature makes people eat ice cream and makes people also swim outdoors. And then some of the people who swim outdoors may drown. There's no lifeguard. The place can be dangerous to swim. So the rules that you see here, outside temperature is connected with ice cream, a chain. Everything on this chain becomes dependent. The same with this one. Outside temperature influences swimming and drowning. So outside temperature is dependent on drowning also, a chain of events. But also, because of the common cause, the effects of that cause become dependent. So ice cream consumption is dependent on drowning. Drowning on the ice cream consumption is because of the common cause. So the common cause makes them dependent. Common causes, when observed, make things independent. When it's warm outside, it doesn't matter how much ice cream was consumed or not, maybe a little because it's all finished and there's no ice cream in stores, so people are eating very little. It has no effect on the probability of swimming outdoors. That outside temperature, the common cause when observed, breaks that connection, the probabilistic dependence. Here is a joke that I don't believe this is a causal graph, but you must have heard or read about the benefit of drinking wine, red wine, on the heart disease. Drinking a little bit of wine is good, the probability of heart disease goes down. The same, of course, the other way, because probabilistic dependence is symmetric, so when wine depends on heart disease depends also on wine. You learn that somebody had a heart disease, you think, oh, maybe he didn't drink enough wine. In any case, they tell you drinking wine is good for your heart. I mean it as a joke. I don't believe that this is true, but it could be explained by a common cause that was unmodeled, that I called life enjoyment. And life enjoyment causes wine consumption and heart disease. When you enjoy life, what do? You go home. After 5:30 you are home. Why so early? Who would work after 5, right? You go home. You chat with your family, with wife, husband, friends, parents. You talk about what happened at work. Maybe you cook together dinner, and you open a bottle of wine and drink a little already. Because, of course, you are not going to work in the evening. Who would work in the evening, right? The same with heart disease. Life enjoyment, you are kind of relaxed. You don't have much stress. The probability of heart disease is also going down. If you are stressed, probability of heart disease goes up. That common cause accounts for the correlation between wine consumption and heart disease. So again, the same rule, life enjoyment causes both, and those both are dependent on one another. Here's another example of that. So that's the second rule. A common cause makes things dependent. There's a strong correlation between being a good surgeon and the death on the operating table. And the funny thing is that that correlation is negative. So top surgeons have usually a higher death rate than beginning surgeons, less experienced surgeons. Why is that? This is probably an explanation of that. There are two paths through which being an experienced surgeon and death on the operating table are dependent. One is through experience, and the other one is through a common cause, the difficulty of the case. When the case is difficult, it goes typically to experienced surgeon, because beginning surgeons will not want to do it. Too difficult for them, they don't feel competent to operate. Also, difficult cases have higher death rate, please note. Higher, from 12 to 22. Easy cases go to less experienced surgeons, and have also a lower death rate. Within difficult cases which go to experienced surgeons, please note that experienced surgeons have the death rate of 20%. Beginning surgeons have death rate of 40%. They are twice as bad. In easy cases, experienced surgeons have 5% death rate. Beginning surgeons have 10%, also twice as bad. The numbers come from my head, but the qualitative, the direction and the correlations, that these are well known. In US, you can check for any surgeon the statistics. So before you undergo an operation, you can actually check how well they do it in terms of statistics. And the funny thing is that good surgeons have worse statistics than beginning surgeons. So, the same rule, common cause, but also a twist on it. You can have multiple connections, and then this experienced surgeon variable influences the death through two paths. One is directly, and the other one is through a common cause. So these are the two rules for the behavior of causality and probability, a chain and a common cause. These two rules have been known for centuries. People knew about them. They're quite easy to understand, to follow. The third and the last are going to be just three rules, is more difficult. And people may have realized it, but it was formally captured by a statistician in 1970s. Nanni Vermut, a German statistician, has described it. She observed it and showed that it is indeed happening in statistics. It happens when you have common effect and multiple causes of that effect. When the effect is observed, the causes become dependent. So normally they may be independent. Barometric pressure, of course, that causes the barometer reading. There's a chain, directed chain. Influences the barometer reading, but doesn't influence the manipulation of the barometer. No common cause, no directed paths, no dependence. The same the other way. When somebody starts fooling around with the barometer, let's say my brother tries to fool me, knowing that I like reading the barometer, blows air into the barometer is going to show high reading. Yes? But it doesn't change the barometric pressure in the outside. So they are independent. But now, when I observe high barometer reading, which changes the probability of these two, of course, through paths, through directed chains, they both become more likely. Now, when I hear on the radio that the barometric pressure is high, please know that it impacts the probability that my brother was involved in trying to fool me. So the causes of an observed effect become dependent. It's conditional dependence. As I said, it's harder for people. It was also formalized later. Here's a slightly more complex example of the same thing. Four different causes of marital problems. Drinking will cause problems in marriage. Please note that drinking does not influence the other ones. They are independent in this model. Addiction influences marital problems, but not the other things. Unfaithfulness also. Strong emotional dependence on parents may also be bad for marriage. They are all independent of one another. They all influence marital problems. But let's now assume that we hear that Bill is having problems, he's getting divorced. Please note that all of the causes of that of the marital problems become more likely. You can ask yourself, was he drinking? Was she unfaithful? You know, etc. You can kind of think about the different causes. But now, when you hear that, Bill is addicted to video games, that impacts the other variables. So they become dependent, conditional on that common effect. Does this make sense? When we think about it, that's exactly what happens. Here, a word of caution to people who do data analysis that involves exactly this effect of common effect and causes. In an intensive care unit, heart problems and lung problems are strongly dependent. If somebody has heart problems, the probability that the person has lung problems becomes less likely. The other way too. So there's a strong dependence between the two. How could it be explained? Heart problems and lung problems are two important causes of being in an intensive care unit. If you have heart problems, they bring you to the intensive care unit, because if your heart stops, your blood is not pumped to the brain. The brain doesn't get oxygen, it starts dying. So very serious conditions. So it's also a reason for being in an intensive care unit. Lung problems, the same. You don't breathe, stop breathing, you don't get oxygen into your blood, your brain starts dying, brain cells. So there are two important reasons for being in an intensive care unit. The two may be independent. But when you observe people in the intensive care unit, you collect your data there, the two are strongly dependent. So the reason for this example is that you need to be very cautious with any type of data set, because the data set may... It's always conditioned on something. It's collected somewhere. Sometimes those conditioning variables make things dependent. Here is just a slightly more complex example of a causal graph. You can see that there are two causes of increased bilirubin level, because there's liver damage. Liver is not able to break off bilirubin, and that substance gets deposited under your skin, and it looks like kind of yellowish, grayish color, which is called jaundice. In Polish, żółtaczka fizjologiczna chyba. Another cause of high bilirubin level may be lethargy. People just feel a little absent. Hepatitis B, which is a viral infection of the liver, can also can damage the liver, and can be also discovered by antibody test. Liver cancer can also damage the liver. So now we can see which things are dependent on one another. For example, we can see that jaundice and lethargy are going to be dependent on one another. If I observe jaundice, lethargy changes. Why? That's a common cause. Liver cancer changes also. Why? Well, there's a path from here to here directly. Liver cancer, hepatitis B is going to be changed. A path and then a common cause, so the antibody test is going to change also. When I observe jaundice, liver cancer and hepatitis B, which were independent at first, these things are changing, but these are just chains. That thing does not change because there's no common cause, there's no chain, there's no observed common effect, but these are changing. They are independent. So hepatitis B observed does not change the probability of cancer. But when I observe jaundice, suddenly these two become dependent, detecting antibodies in blood provides evidence for hepatitis B, which explains why there was jaundice, and this is the reason for the probability of liver cancer going down. Just slightly more complex example with these three different types of interactions: common causes, chains, and common effects. And finally, the last one, also just a combination of the rules. Three different diseases. Oops, I clicked on something. Three different diseases causing fever causing shivering. If you observe meningitis, which is infection of the brain, the fever will change, shivering will change. The other probabilities of the other diseases don't change. The same with flu, you see a chain here. When you observe shivering, of course, all the causes become more likely. But now, if you have evidence for pneumonia, probabilities of the other two are also changing. So just a slightly more complex example. So now coming back to the graph that I have drawn here on the screen. Please note that the graphs that I showed you are subjective. I constructed them. Every causal graph is to a degree subjective, to a large degree subjective, but don't worry that much. It's as subjective as science is. Science is also subjective. For example, a scientist decides what to look at, what to measure, how to measure, and these are decisions that are not in no way objective. In this case, I have created a graph. I think this should not be highlighted, but I'll change it. So when you have a causal graph, and I constructed it out of my head, there are three different causes of flat tire in a car, four different effects of flat tire. Accident can cause car damage, but also injury to people. But people can be also hurt by a knife or a gun. This is meant to be a joke, showing you that it was me who decided how far I go with drawing the picture of the world, the causal picture of the world. So, and also, how do I measure? Do I measure the pressure in the tire, or do I just have a binary variable, tires flat or tires okay? That was my decision. In any case, a graph like this will result in dependencies. For example, glass on the road will be collected with flat tire. You know, there's a chain here. Glass on the road will be also correlated with noise. There's a chain here, this way. Bumpy feeling is going to be correlated with noise through a common cause. In general, it is captured theoretically by an assumption, an axiom, known as a causal Markov condition. The axiom sounds a little bit formally, mathematically, not that easy to understand. You should just trust me that the three rules that I showed you are all results of the Markov condition. They can be derived from Markov condition. It is an axiom, an assumption, but it is used by almost everybody in practice. And as far as I know, there are no convincing counterexamples to it. So it is holding, essentially, in the world. Outside of the quantum world. In the quantum world, we know that it is not holding. There are counterexamples of that, of Markov condition. The implications, we talked about them with the examples, but once again, when there is a chain of variables, directed chain, then everything on that chain is going to be dependent. Thorns and car damage are going to be dependent. Flat tire and car damage. Accident and flat tire. When there's a common cause, that's the second rule, then flat tire is the common cause, and then the noise and car damage, accident, they're going to be dependent through that common cause. We can have common effect. Common effect, when observed, makes the causes dependent. So nails and glass are going to be dependent if we condition on flat tire. These are the three rules which I stated verbally. They're on the slides also, but here they are stated in one place. The next thing is conditioning. When you condition, you can break those connections, chains. If I condition on flat tire, for example, then glass and thorns and nails are going to be independent of the effects of flat tire, because I know the tire is flat, so what caused that tire to be flat is irrelevant. Also, thorns and accident are going to be independent, because the only reason why there may be an accident is flat tire, which is there, we know it. How it came about, it doesn't matter really. Another thing that is useful to know is that they prove that theorem, the proof is very simple, it almost follows from Markov condition. If you intervene on a variable in a causal graph, then the only thing that you need to change is modify the conditional probability distribution of that variable that you are affecting, manipulating. For example, if you have a graph like this, and you intervene on variable A, so you set the value, then the causes of that variable become irrelevant, unimportant. They are no longer in operation. They are no longer working. Here's a joke that I remember I was reading it when I was still very young, long before my dissertation work, my doctoral studies. It's a samurai who is committing suicide, cutting his belly, and then joyfully discovering, oops, I had a cancer tumor. Now, because he's killing himself, he's manipulating, intervening, making himself dead, all other causes of death are irrelevant. Maybe he had a cancer tumor, maybe he had AIDS, maybe he had whatever, you know, tuberculosis, and whatever else. It's becoming irrelevant as a cause of his death. But the consequences of his death are going to be still very predictable based on the graph. So if I take a knife and cut the tire, then the causes of flat tire become irrelevant, but everything else is still valid. Yes, there may be a bumpy feeling. Suppose it's not a knife, but somebody shoots a gun into a tire, a riding car. There will be noise, steering problems, accident, bumpy feeling. All of these are still staying. They are still relevant. Just the effects of intervention, you intervene into a variable, then the causes of the variable become irrelevant. Now, the next thing is experimentation. Empirical research, and that's what this course is about, is usually concerned with testing causal hypotheses. So we want to know whether one thing causes another. Why do we want to know? We talked a little about this. It's because it's very convenient to know it. If I know that, for example, insulting you will result in you'll beat me up, I know it, right? I cannot just go around and insult people because somebody may beat me up. I know it, so I avoid. I don't do that, right? Because I don't want to be beaten up. If I want this room to be lighter, I know that there is a switch there. That switch is connected to the lamp, to the electricity. I press it, the light goes on, right? This is all causal knowledge. Children, humans, are not born with causal knowledge. Psychologists were studying that. There was a Swiss psychologist, Piaget, I think it's early 20th century. Many of his experiments were crucial, and he has shown that children acquire causal knowledge at the age of 5 to 8. So very, very old, actually. They know a lot of things already, and then they start putting together those, you know, things, consequences. Very interesting. You may see, actually, if you have children in your family, little children, you may have seen them, like, coming to the switch, lamp switch, turning it on, and looking, oh, light. Off, on again, and off, and on, and off. Adults will tell them, don't play with that, because we know that the old-style light bulb will break if it's heated and cooled all the time. They don't know it, but they want to test whether this is indeed causing it. They test the causal connection, and they also test whether this is permanent, whether this will always happen. Very much experimenting people, young people. In any case, in experiments, we want to know the causal hypothesis, typically. That's a typical goal of an experimentation. Smoking and lung cancer, we know it, we knew it in the 19th century, that they were related. Because they noticed that among the smokers, there are more lung cancers than among non-smokers. They also noticed that among people who had lung cancer, many, more of them were smokers than non-smokers. It happens in both, of course, but there were smoking and lung cancer were related, clearly. So what does it mean when they are related? Well, if you add the third variable, genetic factors, then you have several graphs that explain that correlation. For example, this one says smoking causes cancer, and genes have nothing to do with it. They don't cause smoking, they don't cause cancer. We know now, actually, that this is not completely true, because we know that there are cancer genes certain genes make it more likely to get cancer. Some people may be exposed to risks and they never develop cancer. Some people are more likely. That is exactly a cause, right? The genes can be a cause of cancer, causal factor. Here are four more graphs in which I'm just playing with the idea of the genes. We know now that this is probably happening. Genes cause cancer. Several types of cancer, we know it. Now, this is also very plausible. Genes cause smoking. We know that some people are born with taste for sweet things. Other people like sour. Other people like drinking alcohol. In case of alcohol, that's I think that they pretty much established that some people genetically are more predisposed to use alcohol. So if alcohol, why not cigarettes? There may be also predisposition to cigarettes. Some people just like the feeling of hot smoke in their lungs. Some people hate it. So this is precisely what our genetic predispositions are. This can be the case. This can be also the case. I think this is the most likely one, but each one of these explains a correlation between smoking and cancer. Here's another one that is interesting. Smoking does not cause cancer. It's all in the genes. So essentially you are born with preference for smoking, and at the same time your genes make it more likely to develop cancer. That's a possibility. These four are meant to be a joke. I don't believe they are true, but they also explain the correlation between smoking and cancer. Essentially, in these four, cancer causes smoking. The story would be something like, you get cancer very early on in your life, maybe as a child, and then at the age of 15 or so, 16, when you first get into relation with, you get in touch with smoking, you realize, oh boy, how nice, that funny feeling I had, I got used to it in my lungs, that goes away when I smoke, right? In that sense, cancer causes smoking, because it causes you to smoke, which is a nice thing, it gives you pleasure, reduces the funny feeling in your lungs. Again, I don't believe this is true, but definitely each of these graphs explains that correlation. So now we have nine different graphs, and a scientist's task is to find out which one it is, which of the graphs is the case, or groups of graphs. We will see that in some of the designs, maybe we will manage to start some of the designs today, you will notice that the early designs rely on groups that are selected using some criteria. For example, eye color or sex. Like, suppose I want to do an experiment with smoking and lung cancer, and I say, okay, you are a man, you are going to be a smoker. You are a man, you are going to be a smoker. Antonina is a lady, she will not smoke. Or I will say, dark eyes, smoker. Light eyes, non-smoker. Light eyes, non-smoker, right? So I use criteria that are possibly related to lung cancer. Who knows, maybe the color of the eye or the genes in the males and females have to do with cancer, right? So if I don't do anything, any tricks, here are the three possibilities, three classes of graphs in one piece. There may be a common cause, there may be a connection this way or that way. As you will see with randomization, we'll talk about it later on, if not today, then 2 weeks from now. Because next week, you know, it's a Friday at the university. So next week we don't have a meeting here. Here is a causal graph for a brilliant idea dating back to early 20th century. 20th century, Western world in general, which is meant by Europe and United States, Canada, you know, the West, has gotten an incredible kick compared to other cultures in terms of technology, science. I think some of that kick is because of our valuing of experimentation, of proving things, experimentation. In Middle Ages in Europe, we were behind some of the cultures, like I know that Muslim science in the Arab world was quite well developed. They took a lot of discoveries from the Greek, from the ancient world, and their science was quite impressive. The Middle Ages in Europe, where people were focusing on other things, they were not stupid at all, they were just focusing on other things, and empirical science was neglected. Empirical in the sense of looking. There are these anecdotes about philosophers arguing how many legs a spider has without actually catching a spider and counting, right? That's an anecdote. I don't think they were that stupid, but essentially that tells us that in Middle Ages there was not enough stress on empirical sciences. And then, you know, more and more, there was this empirical science, measuring, experimenting, and that in early 20th century, so not that long ago, this most popular, most powerful experimental design was proposed. Here is the idea of the design. So we have this graph. We don't know if there is a connection here or here, if there's a connection here or there. We don't know it. We are interested in the connection from smoking to lung cancer, causal connection. So we want to know if smoking causes cancer. What we do is we use randomization. So the idea is that we take something, some device, that is not related to cancer. What is that device? Well, you can find many, right? I can say, okay, this thing, it's not related to cancer. If it falls, I do it one by one with you. If it falls up, you are going to be a smoker. If it falls down, you are going to be a non-smoker. And I throw it in the air for each one of you, and that thing determines whether you are smokers. So it is definitely related to smoking. Of course it is. The smokers will have this up, non-smokers this up. But can you make an argument that this is related to cancer? Probably not. You are spending 20 hours in this room, that's it, looking for which way it fell and causing that cancer. That's kind of stretching it. Of course, you can be superstitious, you can believe in magic, you can, many cultures did that. Our culture is absolutely not excluded from that. Magic, you know, I can dance around you and that will make you better or whatever, right? I can believe in magic, that the way it falls, that will cause cancer. But today we know, at least in our culture, we know that, you know, that is quite stretching, right? Finding the connection between this and cancer. So we find something that has absolutely no connection with cancer. You cannot make an argument that there is a connection. We use it to determine which group a subject is going to be in. So is the subject going to smoke or not smoke? If we do that, please note that this is a perfect manipulation. Depending on the fall of the coin or this device or whatever, a stick, whatever I'm using, a random number generator in a computer, depending on that outcome, the person is going to smoke. Genetic factors are completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter what your factor, what your genes are, you are going to be a smoker from now, right? And you are going to be a non-smoker because that thing fell dead. This connection is no longer working, not acting. It doesn't determine smoking. The same doesn't matter whether somebody of the subject group had lung cancer already or not, doesn't matter, that will not cause smoking, because the only thing that causes smoking is a coin. That's pretty much the way that randomization works in experiments. We use randomization to determine which group the subject is going to be in. What causes smoking? And this is to cut, one of the reasons is to cut these incoming arcs. We see asbestos, we see, of course, even though we cut this arc, there's another arc still there. Genetic factors cause cancer. What we will see is we will see the variability in the results. Remember this experiment, this thought experiment with intercourse and pregnancy. There were many factors there. We kind of talked a little bit about them. They are still there. You cannot get rid of them. How can you get rid of this as a scientist? You cannot. Because the subjects, some of them had exposure to asbestos, some did not. Some have one set of genes, others have another. So this will cause variability. It will not be the case that all smokers get cancer, all non-smokers get no cancer. Because there may be other things that are working here. Some will smoke with filter, some will smoke without filter, for example. That may also make a difference. Another thing that can be easily explained using graphs is the idea of placebo. You must have heard about the placebo effect. In medicine, it's getting better just because you are treated. So if I'm at the doctor and you come to me, and then I look at you, I kind of look everywhere, you know, your ears, your nose, etc., and tell you, okay. Here's what you should do. Every evening before you go to sleep, you should massage your elbows. And here is also a pill I'm giving you. Between us, the pill is just candy, M&Ms that look like pills. Take them every night before going to bed, after supper. But remember, not more than, not later than half an hour before going to bed. I make a whole circus about it. And in fact, this is sugar, you know, massaging your elbows may have no effect on your health. We don't know, but probably it doesn't. You can get better just because you believe that I gave you medicine, I treated you. That's essentially a placebo effect. So in Western medicine, we believe in chemistry. That's what, if you think about it. We don't believe in coming to the patient, you know, petting the patient, you know, giving the attention, which actually heals people. In many primitive cultures, there are shamans. They are, you know, doing all kinds of dances around people, giving them, who knows, maybe the herbs are working, actually, we don't know it, but giving them a lot of treatment that is really, like, symbolic, breathing on them, telling them to kill a frog and put it in earth. I mean, all kinds of magical things. And those things are working, actually. They are making people better. Western world believes in chemistry, though. So we believe only in the chemical working of medicine. There is something to be said about this, because some medicine really works chemically, like antibiotics. They kill bacteria. In some diseases, without antibiotics, you can dance all you want. You will never get better, right? But we definitely, in Western medicine, are missing on that, on exploring the placebo effect. In any case, in Western medicine, we want to distinguish the chemical working of a medicine from placebo. How do we do that? Well, you cannot prevent placebo effect from happening. In an experiment, when you give medicine, you want to check if it works. Definitely, that medicine may have chemicals, but also the fact that I'm giving you medicine makes you better. So what do you do? You cannot get rid of this arrow because a coin will only destroy the incoming arrows. So that arrow, getting medicine, causes the placebo effect, which causes healing. That path is still going to work. But what we do is, in the two groups of subjects, we give one group medicine, and the other group we give what is called placebo, which is essentially sugar pill, something that does nothing to you, right? And so every patient in the experiment is treated the same way, gets that pill, maybe different color, green or red, but feels that is being treated, and the placebo effect is taking place. So what you are observing here in the healing percentage is precisely the chemical working of the medicine. That's it, right? That giving the placebo to subjects causes that to be essentially compensated. If you want to know just the effect of the placebo, what do? You give everybody sugar, right? Then you will see, versus not giving anything. You see how that... So what do you do?
For example, if you want to know the effect of medications only, possible effects, you can probably insert the medication in their food, but without telling them.
Oh, that's right. Of course, yes.
You're trying to. So they are not expecting to be healed or to be cured.
Yes.
And hence, there is no possible effect in some way.
Yes, you're right. You have to, in any case, you have to treat them the same way. But you can do it the same way that you... Probably in hospitals it's harder because, when you know, they prepare food in the same place. They would have to divide the food into two groups, mix it with the medicine. It's harder than just giving them a sugar pill. But you're right. You could do precisely the same, yes. Yeah. You could just... The key is to treat them the same way. That way, whatever happens... There's still placebo effect happening, because they are talking to the doctor. You know, the doctor looks in their eyes. So in experiments, it's very important to treat the subjects the same way. And another effect is called. It's actually a whole class of effects that has to do with subject experimental effects. They are so powerful that they work not only with humans, they work with animals, but they happen with humans, animals, but they also happen with humans themselves, within humans. What are these? This is the... Suppose we have an experiment in a hospital with humans. We have this green pill, which is sugar, and red pill is the medicine, or vice versa, doesn't matter. If I'm the experimenter and I give you the medicine, what can happen is I know that red is the real medicine. I can look at you in a... I'm experimenter, I know. I may look at you differently, even though I don't know myself. It's not on purpose. Let me tell you about an experiment with animals that happened. This was done by one of the authors of a well-known textbook for research design. He did the following experiment. There were two groups of students in a biology lab, and the task was to teach rats to find food in a maze. Maze, a labyrinth. So he came to the two groups, different times, of course, with a box of rats and said, "Your task today is to teach these rats to find food in the maze. Measure the time. You have stopwatches here. And these are special rats. We have bred them for the last 10 years. They are really very smart in finding food in the maze." The other group... water lucky. Sorry. He came with a box of rats, put them the same way, gently, and said, "Your task today is to teach these rats to find food in a maze, and these are just, you know, regular laboratory rats." So the only difference was that he said, "These are the smart rats." And you know, the times that the smart rats found food in a maze were like 70% shorter. Of course, you suspect rightly that the rats were identical, the same rats, not the same rats, the same type. Of course, they cannot be the same because they learn, right? They were identical rats, and so what happened there? Probably the students were treating them better, maybe they were, you know, gentler. After all, it took 10 years to breed them, yes? You have to be very gentle with them. Maybe they pressed the stopwatches a little earlier. Who knows what happened? But you see how strong these effects are. So especially with humans, in medicine, the way you treat your patient is very important. The way you look at the patient, the way you talk, your intonation, your voice. So if you know what you are giving to the patient, that will lead to the different treatment and may actually lead to an effect of treatment. So how do we do that? We blind. This is called blinding the experimenter. Doesn't mean really damaging the eyes. It's essentially making sure that the experimenter does not know which pill is which. So the pills in hospitals are usually administered by nurses, and you don't tell the nurse which is which. You just tell Mr. Jones is getting green and Mr. Brown is getting red. The nurse doesn't know which is which. And that's called blinding. You can also explain it. Blinding is essentially manipulating whether the experimenter knows. The experiment does not know. That kills that connection. So the treatment will not work through this path. It will only work through this path. Causal graphs are, represent causal interactions. And when you do that explicitly, so clearly you talk about causality, you show how things are related, the graphs make the model clearer and easier to understand. We will be drawing sometimes graphs for experimental designs when we play with the ideas. They also explicate the idea that the joint probability distribution from which we get the measurements is shaped by the mechanisms working in the system. So you can explicitly plot those mechanisms. In case of research design, it makes the goal consistent with the means. We want causality. Well, let's make our assumptions explicit in causal terms. It also allows us to understand the scope of experimental design. So what can we do? You will notice that especially when we talk about different ways of experimenting, you can experiment by observation, by experimentation, by quasi-experimentation, then we understand what our limitations are when we have the causal graphs. Assumptions. If there are any assumptions, you can make them explicit in the graphs. And there are a variety of methods of learning causality, experiments, but also observation. So in statistics, it should be treated. Modern textbooks for statistics contain more about causality than the old textbooks. And I think causality will be a prominent topic in statistics textbooks in a few decades, for sure. Do you have any questions about causality and causal graphs? This was just an introduction, and we will be using it practically here and there. If not, then let's start talking about these designs, experimental designs. This is part of there will be three series of slides: experimental designs, quasi-experimental, and factorial designs. Let's start with the experimental designs. Here is a brief overview, an introduction which I will repeat briefly in each of these three. Start with very simple designs, but then continue with more complicated, truly experimental designs. So here is symbolically how different experiments are divided. Experimental designs and quasi-experimental designs are essentially two sides of the same coin. They are called experimental because we have full control over the independent variables. And that means that we can manipulate under full control. Quasi-experimental designs is when you cannot manipulate with everything. You can just do some elements of manipulation. And factorial designs are extending this, both of these, to situations when you have multiple factors. So you have two variables that you are manipulating at the same time, three or more variables. These are called factorial designs. Let's start with experimental designs. Typically, how it works. Well, usually we have a problem. What could be a problem? I may have mentioned that already. My wife worked in this area, cervical cancer in women. A terrible disease, cervix, gets a tumor, can spread in the body. I forgot the numbers, but definitely thousands of women in Poland die every year probably of that, maybe even tens of thousands. So how can we prevent it? What can we do? People had no idea. But then, I think it was 19th century, they realized that that nuns who are in monasteries, they live in celibacy, they almost never get cervical cancer. Almost never. Of course, you know, world is complicated. There can be exceptions. Exceptions can be a nun, a woman who entered the monastery at a later age. Nuns don't get it. And then prostitutes, women who had many partners, were getting more cervical cancer than just general population of women. So then this observation led to a hypothesis. Maybe a sexual intercourse has something to do with it, with cervical cancer. I don't know how they got to the essence, but they discovered this way that it's actually a venereal disease. It's intercourse can spread virus, HPV virus, which causes cervical cancer, can cause, because there are women who had virus and never get it, of course, and there are women who get it very late or very, very quickly. It all depends. There are different strains of the virus also. In any case, we have a problem, then we have a hypothesis. Maybe this is the reason. Then they experiment. Like Alexander Fleming, who discovered penicillin. He made an observation that bacteria did not grow on fungi in the lab. Hypothesis was, maybe the fungi have some substance in them that prevents bacteria from forming, kills bacteria. So he continued with experiments trying to get those substances out of the fungi. And at some point, the experiment was successful. Something that he got out of the fungi killed bacteria. That was the discovery. So usually we have some observations. In this course, we are not going to talk much about how do you formulate hypotheses, how you, start with it. We are going to talk about experiments, which is designing, setting up a study that tests the hypothesis, that proves or disproves it. Actually, we talk about disproving it. So we have smoking and lung cancer. They are correlated. Can we reduce the incidence of lung cancer by reducing smoking? So we need to know if smoking is a cause of lung cancer. That was also an observation. I used it today. You know, people were, among people who had cancer, there were more smokers. Smokers got lung cancer more often. So we have this picture that you saw. And the question is, how can we distinguish between the three groups, actually, this one, no connection, connection from that is causal, and the connection is the other way. How can we do it? We have to be very, very cautious with experimentation, because experimentation is very expensive. For engineers who are setting up something in the lab, that may be not that terrible, although this is also a lot of work. For computer scientists, it's not that much work. We just program everything. We conduct experiments. But if you work in an area of mechanical or civil engineering, setting up experiments is not an easy thing. So it's expensive. It's costly. For you, Antonina, I bet it's not easy, because you need to get the subjects. You need to make an appointment. They come, they don't come, they are late. You need to measure them. A lot of work. So it's a valuable thing, but we use this only when we need it. It's not a panacea to world illnesses. We don't need to test everything. Sometimes things are so obvious that they don't need to be tested. Remember last time, 2 weeks ago, we talked about this idea of the Grünbaum, my discussion with Grünbaum, yes? I told you that about in the context of things that are easy to believe or hard to believe. If it's easy to believe, people don't expect from you to prove it, if it's obvious. But if you say something that is hard to prove, then people expect from you a proof. And in case of that discussion actually started with this idea. He said, where is the experiment proving that St. Anthony helps to find things? I told him, well, there are many truths that are true but never have been tested. What I meant is, there are some things obvious. I don't think there was ever an experiment testing whether insulting somebody will cause them to be to react, the thing that I mentioned today. We don't need to test it, right? It's obvious. Why would you want to test it? It's obvious. If you don't believe it, try it, right? You get beaten up, typically, especially with people, strong people you don't know, right? Try that. So when should we do this experimentation? It's very expensive. Well, we should use precisely where things are unknown, hard to believe, or if you want to convince somebody, if you want to do something against the tradition. Typically, tradition has a lot of wisdom, a lot of truth, but sometimes tradition can be wrong also. We know it. So if you suspect that tradition is wrong, if you have observations or evidence for that, well, you use experiment to prove it. It's a very powerful tool, but very expensive also. So it's not that we love to do it, it's a necessity. And often experiments fail, there can be something that the results are inconclusive. But if something is hard to believe, if you publish something that is hard to believe, you can be sure that people will try to replicate it. You probably were not alive yet when in early 1990s, in physics, there is in theoretical physics, there is a prediction that fusion, nuclear fusion, can happen at room temperature. They call it cold fusion. You've heard that term probably, cold fusion. If we know how to do it, all the world's problem of energy will be lost, will be solved. Because we can have a power station doing nuclear fusion somewhere in the basement of the building, right? We don't need to worry too much. Room temperature. So in early 1990s, there was two scientists from a university somewhere in the southwest of United States. Utah, maybe Utah, who claimed that they have observed cold fusion in room temperature. Of course, immediately, all the ears of the whole world on them. They sent the paper to Science. Science, as you know, is one of those journals where you publish there, you've made it. You know, people will want you, a good scientist. Very hard to get in, very reputable. So they submitted a paper, and Science sent it to reviewers, and the reviewers came back saying, we need more details about this, about that. They did not reject it, but they wanted more details. It turned out that they made a mistake in the design. There was some impurity in the chemical composition of the components that cost indeed more energy than they added. So there was actually more energy at the output, but it was due to the impurities that they did not take good care of. Why am I telling that story? If you produce a paper like this, an experiment, then you can be sure that immediately, worldwide, there will be a few places that will want to replicate that experiment. Replicate means do it again and see if they get the same result. That's especially when something is very, very important and the results are not what people would expect. So if you make a great discovery, how will you know it's great? When people start replicating it and telling, oh, we didn't get the same result. Or we got the same result. The results will be different. For any type of hypothesis, it's very rarely that all the people in all the labs worldwide get the same result. That's another fact of life, essentially. So it's a tedious route. Your experiment may fail. Somebody else will repeat it. Your experiment will show one thing. Somebody else will say, no, it's different. Because the conditions were different, the subjects were different, the chemical compounds were different. So that all may happen. In that sense, it's disappointing, but overall, science progresses because people are doing this tedious, very expensive route of experiments. The next thing that I wanted to say as an introduction is the concept of internal and external validity of experiments. We will talk about, I'll show you that on the next slide quickly. For any experimental design, you can talk about internal validity of the design in the sense of if you see a difference, let's say we have smokers, non-smokers, we have cancers. And then we observe 20 cancers in the treatment group, 10 in the control group. The question is, can you attribute the difference between 10 and 20 to your manipulation, intervention, smoking? Or was it something else? That's essentially the logic of the experiment. Can you logically, with certainty, conclude that the difference could be only because of your intervention? As you will see in the different designs, it's not an obvious question. And there are certain things that can happen that can bring internal validity into question. The second type of validity is external. External validity is about generalization of the results. Can you generalize your results to wider population than just your lab? And again, we will talk about examples in detail, so you will understand every one of them. Here is the list of threats to internal validity. Again, no need to read it now. I just wanted to show you the preview. We'll talk about each of them in separation in detail. So 8 threats to internal validity and 4 threats to external validity. In describing experiments, I'll use the notation from a textbook by Campbell and Stanley. It's a very thin book, 40 pages. It used to be a paper that they published as a book. I remember when I was teaching in Pittsburgh, I advised students not to consider buying it because it was the most expensive book per page. 40-something pages, it was like $50, $60. Copying was less expensive, definitely. If I don't forget, I'll bring the textbook to to our meeting next week, in 2 weeks from now. So the notation is the following. When you have multiple lines with groups, and in every group there can be symbols. There are three symbols only. X means treatment, R means randomization, and O is measurement, testing. Things happen from left to right. So let's do it in practice. This is the first architecture that I'm going to talk about. It's a one-shot case study. Essentially, you have one group, because there's one line, you see one row. In that group, first we treat, X is treatment, and O is a measurement. It's a very simple design. Those of you who know programming, and I guess these days everybody knows how to program a little, sometimes I ask my students, computer science students, what is the best searching algorithm? The answers are different. Some people say binary search. Binary search works in the following way. You have an array, a vector of values. You shoot in the middle. The vector is sorted. You shoot in the middle. And then if the thing that you are looking for is higher, then you throw away the bottom. You go into the top, divide by 2 again, by 2, by 2. You find something in a sorted array in a logarithm of n steps. Antonina knows it well. That's probably the fastest algorithm, the best, if you have a sorted vector. But and what if, when it's large, it's the time is logarithm of n. If you have million elements, in 10 steps you can find, no, 20 steps, I think. In 20 steps you can find something very, very fast. But what if you have only 10 elements to search from? Like you are searching, you are comparing day of the week to a table of dates of the week. 7 elements. What is the search mechanism algorithm that's best? Probably linear search gives you in 3 steps on the average, right? So the correct answer to the question, what is the best search algorithm, is it depends. It's a very frustrating answer, of course, for an engineer. It depends, but that's what it is. What is the best experimental design? It depends. Now, this design, as you will see, is very simple, very stupid, has a lot of problems. But I bet you apply this design on a daily basis in your life. How does it work? Well, you do something and you look at the effect. What would be... I've never been in this room. I'm lifting the blind to see if it has a big effect on the screen, right? A child who is experimenting, you know, with the switches and so on, manipulating and observing the effect. As a teacher, I experiment a lot. I do things that I've never done sometimes. I do something and I observe the effect on the students. And if I observe that, oh, it looks like they reacted nicely or they learned something, I conclude it was my manipulation. Not a very sound conclusion, but very often I do it. Why do I do that? Such an inexpensive experimental design, such cheap, like linear search among 7 elements. You compare one by one. On the average, n over 2. If I have a million elements that are sorted, doing linear search would be stupid. It would take me 500,000 steps to find something on the average. Yes. So then the binary search is best. I'll just finish this and we will break. So we have a simple group of subjects. It's very easy and widely applied. We will discuss the problems with it later in the context of better designs. I'll just tell you a joke and we'll finish. On the next slide I have more about this design. But just a joke. This is a joke that I heard in elementary school, very old. A researcher in biology lab has a frog. He taught the frog to jump when he ordered. So he said, "Frog, jump," and the frog jumped. So then he wanted to check something, and he cut off the front, one of the frog legs. Frog jump. Frog jumped. He wrote down in his notebook, the frog jumped. He cut the second leg. It was harder for the frog, but frog jumped, the frog jumped. He cut one of the back legs. Frog jumped. It was difficult for the frog, but the frog definitely made an attempt to jump. He cut the fourth leg. Frog jump. Frog jump. Frog jump. Nothing. He wrote down. After cutting the fourth leg, the frog lost the sense of hearing. Of course, that's a joke, a stupid joke, but you realize that in this case of this